The first book deal I ever did was for $75,000. This is after the free one. So I went from zero to 75, not bad.
Tell us how you got into ghostwriting first.
Honestly, it's pretty siloed. It can be hard to figure out who and where to go to for this work. If you are out there thinking like, I love to write, I love people's stories, I love narrative, I can do this. The answer is you can absolutely do this.
It seems like it's a way to make good money. You seem to make good money doing it.
We had less than 3 months to write the entire manuscript. We did that. That book became a Wall Street Journal bestseller.
To the would-be ghostwriter in the audience, the sorts of deliverables, the process, how you're pricing this, anything from like the back end nuts and bolts in the weeds of the business of ghostwriting, what can you give us?
Yeah, I can give you, I'll give it all to you minus names.
Welcome back to the Creator Spotlight Podcast. My name is Francis Zierer, and today we're speaking with Maxie McCoy, a writer who has been building online since 2009. Her decade-old newsletter has around 40,000 subscribers, and she spent years building community in a previous role, which is a favorite topic of this podcast. But the primary reason I wanted to speak with her is for her ghostwriting work. She is a 2 times published author, having self-published her most recent novel, but the primary way she makes her living is ghostwriting books for other people. So we'll talk about the economics of that. And it's a good conversation. I hope you enjoy. You are an author. You are a ghostwriter. I believe you're a speaker. You do a bunch of things. Just to contextualize, what are the arms of the business of Maxie McCoy here in 2026?
Yeah, well, I'll tell you the arms of the business after I tell you where the arms sprout from, which is all of my work is around making sure women's stories don't go untold. And so what that ends up looking like, what those arms end up becoming, are everything that you just named, right? I think when we think about the knowledge creator economy, that is me. My expertise is in this narrative storytelling. That ends up looking like ghostwriting. It ends up looking like speech writing. I do my own public speaking, my own books. Mm-hmm. I have courses on LinkedIn that are mailbox money. I have done brand partnerships over the years. It does get hard to put it in a box, and especially over time, right? I've been writing on the internet since 2008, and I've had my newsletter since 2012. And so I have figured myself out online. It has evolved. The revenue streams and the arms have evolved. And I've evolved. And so, it gets fun to then try and put it back into this container. What do you do?
So that's a lot of things. That's a lot of arms.
It is.
What percentage of the whole does each arm make up today in 2026?
Yeah. Today in 2026, the ghostwriting and the speech writing is 90% of it, because that is where my focus has gone over the years. And I will say that it's going to cycle back out probably. So ghostwriting and speech writing behind the scenes work has been a large majority. When I look at what I'll be doing over the next 5 years, it'll be a lot of me front and center in the revenue streams, kind of proving that point. And I think those are the natural cycles that I sort of get into in this like create, cultivate, coming back out, especially when you think about books, you think about newsletters. Like my work has always been, I'm writing about a body of work. I am creating around a body of work. And so when my first book, You're Not Lost, came out in 2018, it was from at that point almost 6 years of building offline community. And so I was with women day in and day out. I was writing about that. And the book, You're Not Lost, sprouted from that body of work. And that'll happen. That cycle will happen again. My next body of work was and is ghostwriting and speechwriting. But now I'm starting to talk about that work and creating around what is happening behind the scenes, which is
You've
just like an interesting
long enough to talk about it.
Yeah, exactly. Because otherwise, I don't know, I found myself in this like, I'm trying to create thought leadership for thought leadership's sake. But like, what is the thought leadership actually about?
Mm-hmm. You need to have had the thoughts to leadership them. Horrible phrasing there, but you know what I mean. Okay, back in 2008, right. you said you've been writing on the internet since 2008. What were you doing back then?
Where did I was in college. I had the longest running column for the Brown and White Lehigh University's journalism paper. And it was online also, because everything had just kind of, you know, started to hit the internet in that way. And it wait for the title, it was called The Real McCoy. I also started to build out my first online digital portfolio at maximccoy.com. So I had a sense of personal branding because of my father from a very early age. He actually is the first one that bought me the URL. I was spring break, my sophomore year, and I get a GoDaddy like forwarded email from my dad saying, I bought you maximccoy.com.
GoDaddy.
Yeah, GoDaddy. Sorry, that's awful. I haven't thought that joke before, and I'm stealing it. It's going on tour. That's amazing. GoDaddy is right. And so that's what I was writing then. But when it became the form that many of us know now was really 2012. I was working at a company called Levo, which was like a LinkedIn for women. Mm-hmm. I was running all of our offline communities. So I had 30 cities around the world where I built out all of the programming, built out the ambassador program, was on a plane, you know, in each one of these cities to make sure this work was continuing. It was a venture-backed company at the time. This was kind of pre and right at the cusp of Lean In. So you have kind of that first phase of all of that. She was one of our investors. Sheryl Sandberg, thank you. And I realized really quickly there was a lot happening offline that could be cycled back online. And there was a lot of conversations I was having with women that it didn't appropriately funnel itself into this like very specific career platform. It's like the platform was talking about, why are we not negotiating for our salary? But I wanted to talk about what was happening underneath the surface level of all of that. And so I was like, well, let me start writing about it. There was a very successful blogger on the team at Levo named Carly Heitlinger. She's an amazing human. And she was like, Maxie, I'll teach you how to do this. And so, you know, while I was working in a community aspect, I was also experiencing the success that comes from community. She's an example. And if we were to take 2012 all the way to 2026, every single great thing that has happened to me has been because of someone in a community that is saying my name behind a closed door, showing me how to do something, putting me in front of their audience. And, you know, over the years, I now have something to do the same with.
Yeah. I want to talk a bit about your different eras of how you've shown up online, but I want to put that a little later. First, I want to talk about a through line through these different eras, which is your newsletter. It's called In My Library. You first started sending it in 2012. I believe it's changed a little bit over the 14 years you've been sending it. And when we first spoke about doing this, you told me that you were around 40,000 subscribers there. So that's the table set. Tell us about what this newsletter is and how it's changed. First, I guess, why you started it, what it was then, what it is now, and how and why it's changed between these two points.
Yeah. The fact that you have noticed that it has evolved is something that actually until you said that, I hadn't really thought, like, 14 years is a long time. I've evolved. It has evolved. And there was a period of time where I resisted that evolution, and we can get into that. But I started it in 2012 because newsletters were a thing then. And so I knew if I was writing online, I also wanted to be able to capture and build relationship with the people that might be reading me. Now, when that first started, it was really tactical because one of the key ways I was building my readership was by showing up on other people's blogs.
Tried and true.
I would, yeah, it's so tried and true. I would guest blog on people with a much, not always a much bigger, sometimes just a small bigger audience than me. And I wanted to give them something to come to me for. The one thing I knew I was pretty good at, back to the programming piece, was asking questions that would get them to their own answers. So I would create these worksheets, downloadable worksheets that if I was doing a guest blog for you, there'd be this, you know, little hyperlink at the bottom that, oh, if you want to take this topic further, come download this worksheet. And then they knew, obviously, that they were being opted in to my newsletter. And that really built over the years. I mean, I did that for so long, Francis, like, and it really did build an audience that, because they were getting another experience from me, they were there and they got what we were about. We just meaning me and them. And so it started then, and the newsletter really was very simply me writing every week about what was on my mind, what I was noticing that these women who I was spending day in and day out in these Lavo communities, what they were talking about when they weren't at the very like specific career workshop. And so it was me doing a few things. I mean, I've always been a writer. So it was me writing, the experience of writing, me writing for them, like, well, okay, if these women are experiencing this and I really relate to that, I'm going to write it. And then every time it would go out, I would always get the response back, are you inside my mind? And I was like, no, I'm not inside your mind, but I am listening to what women like you are saying and experiencing. And that's actually a lesson that has taken me all the way to today, which is obviously I'm going to default into what I want to say. It's neuroscience, right? Like, we're really worried about what we're going to say. But actually, an audience is thinking about themselves. And so how can we take a single beat to write what they might be thinking about? And my hack into that is really just listening. Even with my book, You're Not Lost, and this is advice I give anybody trying to write a book, is like, yeah, you have what you want to say, but if people that this book that you're writing it for aren't expressing that problem with those words, it's probably not going to resonate. And so that was the beginning of the newsletter. The reason I evolved the newsletter is because around 2020, 2021, I found myself, I had been every week for, at that point, 8 years, had been writing this newsletter. I found myself not wanting to write it. And that felt weird. There was this world where I could have not written it, or thanks to a very good messaging first brand expert who happens to be one of my besties, she was like, what about evolving it? What about turning, you're always the one texting links, telling us about this, recommending that. And she was like, what about like curating? Some curation and some storytelling. And so now that is what, about 4 years ago, it became in my library.
What was it called before?
It was, honestly, it was just like my newsletter. Like, just it was Maxie's just from newsletter. Coming from, yeah. Maxie. Yeah, it didn't really have a name. It like had my Maxie signature at the top.
And now, I mean, there's these links, but as is the case with most great curation newsletters, most curation newsletters that engage an audience long term, there's the link, but really what people come from for is the paragraph after the link where you're giving the context and why it matters to you.
Do you read curation newsletters?
Some of them.
Any?
My newsletter consumption is so warped, far more warped than the average person's, because I have probably 100+ of them in my inbox. So I'm more piecemeal in my in my consumption.
I'm more
the person writing
one. So many. Yeah, I get it. I have found when there are, similar to you, there's like an onslaught of newsletters and information that come. But I actually think that makes voices that we resonate with and we just are like, I like their vibe. Mm-hmm. When they have something interesting that they are reading the internet, I'm like, well, great. Let me actually just click on those, because being addicted to feeds and reading everything, I'm similar to you. I'll go down like every possible rabbit hole. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, it is nice to have someone doing the work for you.
Yeah. Well, wait, okay. So a couple of questions. So the 40,000 or so people in the audience.
Yeah.
I'm curious where they came from. You're talking about these sort of blogging exchanges, but it also sounded like in something you said a second ago, it sounded like a good portion of them came from your status as sort of a minor deity in the Laevo network, right?
People
it sounds like
minor deity.
I think that's how communities work. Every community has a network of major and minor deities, right? And I think it's apt with the church metaphor, right? It's like, when I say minor deity, I just mean like a sort of, it's like, it's kind of
your
like
personality, I mean, within
a personality that people come for that has like that represents a certain system of values and status, and you want proximity to them, or they're a common topic of conversation among other people in the community. Mm-hmm. It's this common touch point, right? But all of which to say, you were clearly in your role convening and setting up these communities and managing this network of, I think it's 50 some volunteers you describe on the LinkedIn. You were some sort of minor deity in this community. So of course people in these communities would want to subscribe to your newsletter and get the word from you, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. It's very right, because you so understand this world, and you're reflecting to me probably something I haven't thought about in a long time, which is that is true. Mm-hmm. So that newsletter grew. Yeah. You become like it was a well-funded platform, and there was a world where, had we been more evolved, I probably would have been building that newsletter within that platform, but we just hadn't evolved to that place yet. And so, it built from there, very much so. And I still meet and talk to women from those days. I mean, that's more than 10 years ago. And knowing where I played a role, where Laevo played a role, they're still on my newsletter. I had a really fun experience. This is in the recent past, but where someone who their platform is now fully popped off, and we were talking about ghostwriting for them. Mm-hmm. They found me all of those years ago and have been subscribed to my newsletter since those days. And like, what a fun full circle. So yeah, it definitely built. It built from blog exchanges. It built from this community, just personality profile.
If you're a creator, you probably did not get into this to spend hours uploading files, writing tags, organizing assets, and digging through analytics. That's why OpenVideo built an MCP server just for creators. It lets an AI agent manage the operational side of your video business from a single prompt, uploading, tagging, organizing, and analyzing your entire channel for you. And unlike traditional platforms, it all happens on infrastructure you control. So let AI do the busy work while you do the important work of creating content your audience can't live without. See how you can do more with AI at open.video/MCP. That's open.video/MCP. Yeah, let's talk about the ghostwriting, because that is partially why I wanted to have you on in the first place, right?
Yeah.
Our episode with Nicholas Cole from November is our most listened to, at least on YouTube so far. It's a hot topic. People are interested in it. It seems like it's a way to make good money. You seem to make good money doing it.
I do.
Tell us how you got into ghostwriting first, and then I've got plenty of other questions. But how did you start working in ghostwriting?
Yeah. So the story I always tell is my agent called me right when my book with my name, You're Not Lost, came out in 2018. And as I'm like going on this major book tour, she's calling me. She's at UTA. And UTA, as some may know, United Talent Agency, is one of the three major talent agencies for celebrities, public figures.
Minor deities.
Yeah, minor deities, exactly. And she calls and says, hey, you love to write. Your work is, at this time, I very much was like, facilitating stories is like this key thing that I'm doing. Have you ever considered ghostwriting? And I was like, is this something that I need to be? Oh, I don't know. My book just came out. And so I didn't really like think much about it. The reason I say to you that this is the story I always tell is because a couple weeks ago, I realized that there's this other part of my career that I did very quietly and never talked about.
Back in 2010.
Which was like, yes, in 2010. I actually, I ghost wrote someone's book for no money. In 2010.
This like a sort of fresh out of college, like I need to get like experience type of thing?
Yeah. It was just like it showed up. I thought it would be interesting. I had always wanted to write a book. They were two entrepreneurs in Dallas who wanted to self-publish because it's a true entrepreneurial experience and they needed someone to write it. And I was like, I could do that. This sounds fun. You know, I was a journalism in undergrad. Originally, I thought I was going to go into sports broadcasting and had been on air talent and, you know, and then was kind of like backing off from all of that and trying to figure it all out. And so in 2010, I ghostwrote their book for free. It was called Less Work, More Money. It was their story.
More work, less money. Come on.
100%. And for some reason, I had never really until these last few weeks, like connected the fact that actually that's probably what made me feel really comfortable 8 years later when my agent called. But I said yes. And then what it became was so much of what I love, which is asking people questions, getting them to answers. And I know you know this work because you're doing it right now, right? You're getting them to insights they didn't even know that they had or were going to get to. And then being able to draw that down on the page. So I said yes. And when I went through the interview process, wasn't sure how that was going to go. You know, they're basically trying to get a sense of what kind of things you've written, what kind of vibe you are, how you're going to run the process. And do they want to spend the next 2 years with you? Mm-hmm. What I've now learned on a far side of this is I also am interviewing now for that. You know, is this topic matter that I can dive into? It's a long engagement. Yeah. So I interviewed, I got it. And I was like, guess I'm doing this. Frances, I was so committed to learning her voice that I hand transcribed every single phone call. But I really thought, like, if I can get this into my literal body, I'll be able to do the job I need to be able to do of like really metabolizing her and her voice and her stories. And that book, we actually ended up typically a major publishing deal. You have 6 months to write the manuscript, the like first draft. We had, because of the timing of some of her shows and when they were airing, we had less than 3 months to write the entire manuscript. We did that. And that book became a Wall Street Journal bestseller. And so because of that, it creates, as you can imagine, a flywheel of interest, of
makes your
resume
agent's job much easier to go grab one of these for you.
Exactly.
Well, okay, wait.
And,
so
and I loved it.
In a nuts and bolts sense, so you said it might take about 2 years for one of these engagements. What I know you can't tell us like specific clients, there's plenty of NDA stuff here, but anything you can like to the would-be ghostwriter in the audience, the sorts of deliverables, the process, how you're pricing this, anything
Absolutely.
From like the back end nuts and bolts in the weeds of the business of ghostwriting, what can you give us?
Yeah, I can give you, I'll give it all to you minus names. So the, you know, when you are, if you are out there thinking like, I love to write, I love people's stories, I love narrative, I can do this. The answer is you can absolutely do this. It then becomes understanding how publishing works. The reason that understanding traditional publishing and why that matters is because typically somebody that is paying someone to be a ghostwriter is either has a lot of cash that they're going to throw at self-publishing, and that's fine. Or they have a lot of cash because they got it from a book deal. And in order to get a large book deal, you have to understand what gets someone to a book deal to begin with. Because as a ghostwriter, if you, Francis, are saying, I want to go get a major book deal, Maxie, I need you to help me do that. That's first going to look like something called a book proposal. It's a 40-page business plan for a book. It does this really interesting dance of both selling why this book is going to be a major success for that publisher and the editor who acquires it. And also, by the way, I have incredible stories and I'm a great writer. So it is a really specific medium. That book proposal, I tell people, do it in 3 months. If it's taking you more than six, you run the risk of someone else writing it, the topic not being fresh, missing the moment. And you want to understand the ecosystem that you are creating this book proposal in. One of the ways you can do that, this is in the business of ghostwriting, there's something called publishersmarketplace.com. Mm-hmm. It's $25 for a monthly subscription. Once you pay the $25, you cancel it. I didn't say that, but you can cancel it like after the first month if you just want to do some download research. But you can see every book deal that's happening in major publishing, who the agent is, what their contact information is, and which editor at which publishing house that they sold the book to, and for how much. They don't give the exact number, but there's like tiers and like certain words mean a certain amount. And so when you have that knowledge, you can use all of that to essentially sell your book idea within a proposal. The biggest thing when you are a ghostwriter is you have to be the person that is helping your author differentiate their idea, because they're going to think their idea is amazing. It typically is, but it also has to be something that is going to be differentiated in the market. Otherwise, an agent isn't going to want to represent it, and an editor at a major publishing house isn't going to want to buy it. Mm-hmm. When I first started, I was charging, I think my first book proposal was $5,500. Now, if you are having me do a book proposal, it's $20,000. That is the first piece of the engagement. These contracts are typically done at the same time. So it's a contract that covers, you did this within the book proposal, and if we get a deal, then these are the terms. So the first book deal I ever did was for $75,000. This is after the free one. So I went from zero to 75. Not bad.
Well, you know, sometimes you got to work for exposure. So we've all done it.
I do say I have like a lot of talk tracks on working for free, which everybody says not to work for free. But if you know what your trade-offs are and you can see where that's getting you and you're strategic about it, it's some of the best things
it's
I've
good
ever done.
Sometimes.
Yeah, 100%. But you gotta know the trade-offs. So yeah, the first book proposal was for $75,000. Now, if I'm writing a book, it's for $150,000. So that is, I've doubled that in, how many years is that? Eight?
Seven?
Yeah. Yeah, seven, eight.
Six, seven.
What is my Sorry. Lifetime line, Francis? Yeah, please tell me. And so, but you know, I have peers who are in the 175 to 250 mark. You then have JR doing Prince Harry's for $1 million, right? And so there's a range there, but you have to know what that looks like over the course of 2 years, their long engagements, how they get paid out. So you write these contracts. Everyone often asks me about credit. And so these are all just like contracting dials, right? Mm. So I'm not somebody who needs to be acknowledged or needs to be on the cover of someone's book. That's not like, oh, I don't need it because I have no ego. It's not that. It's literally just because I have my own books and platform. Mm-hmm. It's just not something I just personally, just truly.
You serve your own ego elsewhere. Yeah.
Yeah. No, my ego is coming from somewhere else. Totally. And I actually don't think having your name on a book is ego. It's just like what matters to you or not. Right. Mm-hmm. for me, it doesn't matter. So like that's a dial I get to turn down and then turn up in other places. The thing about publishing is they're slow to publish these books. The payout schedules are long. And so in the course of my publishing career, it used to be books were paid when you sign, half is signed on signing the book deal. And then 50% would come when you would turn the manuscript. They call it acceptance and delivery. You've delivered and the editor accepts. That is when the other 50% would come. Over the course of the years, though, that has now been broken into quarters. So, and some of it is like 6 months after the book publishes. So then you're on this like, will I ever see this money? Talking about
some like net 90 type of thing.
Yeah.
On a larger scale.
Yeah. So I am very specific in my contracts that all of mine gets paid between when I sign and when I deliver that book, because that's what works for me. And those are part of the negotiation. And so, you know, understanding numbers, like where you're at, like when I mentioned some of my peers are in these other places, well, some of my peers have multiple New York Times bestsellers. I don't have a New York Times bestseller yet. Mm-hmm. Right. And so you're kind of taking these milestones. And
You've ghostwritten a Wall Street Journal bestseller. Am I correct?
I have. Right. Yeah. Yes. Mm-hmm. Correct. And so, you know, you're just taking these milestones and doing what makes sense. And over the years, I've gotten pretty bold about asking other people their numbers. Like I had a woman on a call where she was thinking about changing ghostwriters. And there was, you know, there was someone that was really amazing, really successful, but personally not working out for her for a variety of reasons. Very amicable. And I said, I was like, I would really, if you're open to it, I would love to know what you were paying him. Here are my numbers. I'm not going to change mine. It is what it is. And also, I would like this moment to learn what someone at that level with those credentials and or lack thereof was charging you. And so, you know, these are the lessons for any creator in any career. The more that we can have conversations about numbers, it is why the work that you're doing is really important. The more that we can learn and titrate and have something to reach for and ask for advice. And yeah. And so that's what the numbers are right now. And, you know, sometimes they come below, sometimes they go above. It just oftentimes can depend on how the project is coming together. And that changes from situation to situation.
Mm-hmm. Also, to make one thing clear before I move on to the next thing. So when we talk about ghostwriting for you, it's specifically ghostwriting entire books. That's what your ghostwriting work is.
Speeches. There is work within the founder executive ghostwriting and speechwriting that I have done. But when I am like the thing I am most passionate about and the thing that I am, you know, what I would consider an expert in is these very large project publishing books that we'll get into the speechwriting and why that has become an output of it. But yeah.
Okay. I want to talk about your own work as an author, not ghostwriting, your own work as an author. You are a two-time published author. We've already talked a little bit about one of your books. The second one is Daisy, a novel about the founder of the Girl Scouts. And I would bet that a lot of our audience, myself included, has dreamed of holding a book with their name on the cover. You did an interview for a friend of the pod, Lindsay Stanberry's newsletter, Purse, a few months ago, detailing the process and cost of producing this novel. And it cost you about $32,000. The biggest expense of that was $17,000 on your writing coach, which I want to talk about that in a second. But could you give us a abbreviated narrative of what it took to produce this, both in the creative sense of, you know, I was writing this much for this long, and in the weeds financial sense, a bit of the highlights from that $32,000.
Yeah. Yeah. So like I mentioned, fiction was something that I always thought I wanted to write. I think much of the audience, when we consider ourselves creators or creatives, anybody listening to this, we end up with these like kind of other things that like, oh, that'd be really interesting. Or like you hear someone else do it, you're like,
wouldn't that be neat?
Oh, wouldn't that be neat? That was always fiction for me. A, because I'm a big reader, and I lived in San Francisco, I was visiting Savannah, Georgia, and came across the story of Juliet Gordon-Lowe, who's the founder of the Girl Scouts. She, you know, lived at the turn of the 1800s to 1900s and created the Girl Scouts in 1912. So it's historical fiction. Mm-hmm. And came across this story and was like, whoa, this doesn't feel like it's anywhere. So I call my agent, same agent that we were talking about with the ghostwriting, and pitched her this idea. And she said, that sounds incredible. Go run at it. You know, we talked about life rights. We talked about how historical fiction works when someone, you know, you're writing about someone who's dead and kind of had to get into all of that. And I knew, because I had a number of years of false starts, that I wouldn't be able to deliver what, like, I chose as my first thing, a very well-known organization, and within that world, a very well-known woman, to be like, oh, I'm going to go write my first fiction about this. And so I was like, I need to A, do this right, to respect the legacy of someone that is revered, a major deity in this world, to bring it all the way back. And I need accountability. And there's clearly a craft issue here of why I can't get past that 10, 15% false start. So because of like proximity to publishing, I had heard about this program called Authors Accelerator, mm-hmm. where a woman named Jenny Nash trains book coaches, both in nonfiction and fiction, so that they can help you get your book written. A little bit different than ghostwriting, right? Someone who's, they're not writing it on the page, they're coaching you through your
A writing
pages.
Coach is, as I understand it, it's basically an editor that you're imposing on yourself.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. 100%. I needed one of those because I also needed to learn the craft of fiction. And so over the course of from 2021 to 2024, so 3 years, I was engaged in writing this draft. It went through 3 major revisions. So I wrote it first, gave it to my agent, and she was like, we've got some major craft issues in this. In order to sell it where we wanted to sell it, it needed some other plot lines. It needed some more development of specific themes. So then I did another major revision. And then after that revision, we were in a good place. And it was like, okay, well, to sell this at the number we all had in mind. And when I say number, it's probably just a major six-figure deal is what we were hoping for. That number then goes up and down from there. It needed another revision to get it what we and when I say we, it's me, my agent. She brought in another agent at UTA who specializes in women's fiction, and then my writing coach. So real team sport happening here. Mm-hmm. Big dreams for it. Thought I was going to make that $17,000 back in writing coaching in like an easy minute. Easy meaning the hardest I've ever worked for 3 years. Yeah. But thought that it was just like, I don't even need to worry about that $17,000 because it is coming back in spades. It did not come back in spades. So it went out for submission, which is when an agent takes a manuscript out. So when we were talking about ghostwriting for nonfiction, a book proposal goes out.
Okay. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
When you are writing for fiction, what goes to editors is a fully done camera ready manuscript. Mm. So that thing was out after 3 years and $17,000 in book coaching. And the first 10 editors, and then it became another batch of 10 more, they all passed. And the feedback on those passes is typically what's going to give you insight into what you need to rework, redo, revise. And then a few years later, you can probably submit it again. I was in a pretty unique position where my agents they're tough cookies, so they're not hiding anything from me. They said, don't touch it. This was a market trend timing issue. Historical fiction sales were down. Debut authors were not performing well at this specific you know, like within this genre. And they were like, but Jenna Bush Hager was just in our office asking where all of the historical fiction is. And we said, go tell the editors that, because the editors are passing on things like Daisy. And they passed on, Daisy is the name of my novel. They passed on me and Daisy with kind remarks. Love Maxie, love Daisy, not going to do this deal. I was like, rip it to shreds, please, yeah. For the love of God. Rip it to shreds, because this is not helpful at all. It leaves you to be like, oh my God, I just gave so much time. I canceled weekend trips to get editing, you know, in and certain times. Like I thought it was going to be the next phase of my career was like me as a fiction author. Mm-hmm. And so really good lesson not to get attached to the outcome, because the outcome didn't remotely happen. And so what then ended up happening, to come back to the financials. So I had that investment of the 17K. My agent's recommendation was to go ahead and write your next one. And we will come back. Historical fiction will have come back around, and we'll do a 2-book deal. Ideally, right? Again, this is all pie in the sky ideal. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh my God, I have to go write another one. But what happens with this now just becomes a Word document in the cloud for the foreseeable future. Like, this was so much of my
years
life, friends.
Life.
You can tell.
You moved
in my
across
energy,
the country
like,
to write it.
I did. Mm-hmm. And I did that kind of like newbie mistake where I talked about it constantly. Like, I used to joke the like most serious relationship I'm in right now is with a woman who died 100 years ago. Like, that's how involved I was in this thing. And, you know, now I'm almost done with my second draft of like the next novel, and nobody knows about it because I just learned a lesson in life.
Well, now I know about it.
Well, you know about it, and now the listeners know about it. To come back to the investment though, I had a choice in that moment. I actually had a dream where like I saw myself like not waiting and having like Daisy in my hands, and I was like, oh, okay. Like, I'm just going to do this thing. I'm going to put out some copies of this book. And originally I thought I was going to just print like 150 copies for family, friends, some followers who might want to read this like unperfect self-published book. And as I was running those numbers, I found this really amazing, like bespoke publisher in the Bay Area called Edition One Books. They're, you know, a boutique publishing. So you can go the Amazon route. You can go the Ingram Sparks, right? This is like major distribution. You can get books in retailers. But I knew that if I wanted Daisy to be a part of a major publishing deal, bring my ego back into this, I actually couldn't do that. And my agents told me that, like, we can't have an ISBN number against this book, because then you most likely won't be able to have it a part of a second book deal. So I was like, okay, let me print 150 copies. And as I'm running the numbers, and we know this, like the numbers of scale, it was like, I could have paid $11,000 for 100 copies, or $15,000 for 1,000. These are not the right numbers, but you get the general math. And so I was talking, you know, back to the man that bought my first URL. I was talking to my dad, and I was just kind of like running the numbers with him. And he was like, Maxie, if we gave you $5,000 as a like investment in this process, would that get you to go for the bigger number? And for some reason, Francis, even though the whole thing didn't cost $5,000, that $5,000 was just this delta between being able to say, yes, like, let's just go spend this other, you know, $16,000.
That's an injection of belief. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's a really great way of putting it. So then I had a little mini monster on my hands, because I had the investment of, you need to, and anyone who self-publishes this you need to know that these are the pieces, right? You become responsible for laying the text in the format of a book file. You have to design your own cover. You may not have to pay the upfront of printing and shipping, because if you use like Ingram Spark or Amazon, they handle all that for you. But I wanted something beautiful. I did this like gorgeous yellow linen with like a green foil. I did something that made me just like really proud of the product and was something that could be a keepsake, because that's how I framed this like small run of books, is this limited edition keepsake book. They're numbered, they're signed. And so all of those were moments of investment. And then I had, you know, I had to like make calls to friends. Hey, you've got a warehouse. Can I have these two pallets of books there? And then I was stamping them. I was putting the patches in them. I did this little like daisy chain library card. I signed them all. I numbered them all. And that was all investment of time and energy that got us from that 17 of book coaching to the like 33 number, so of all in.
When you did the person interview too, you said that this was in December of 2025. You said that you'd recouped about one third of that. Has that number gone up?
Yeah. Yes, it's gone up. I was just checking the numbers before this. I'm at about half. So I'm about half of that recoup. And our friend of the pod, Lindsay, is a big reason why. Hmm. So much of her audience between when that piece came out and today has been buying Daisy. And so that has been really fun to find people who love historical fiction, who love women's fiction, who, you know, love the, you know, the underdog indie writer, like fiction writer story, and they just supported. And so, yeah, that has moved up. I was checking it to about half.
Nice. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Okay.
We got to get that other half, though.
You got to get that other half. Maybe some people listening right now will go buy it. When we first spoke, you told me that you've tested courses both yourself as the course teacher side and as a consumer. You've spent a lot of money doing courses. And to quote, you think most education products are bullshit. Tell me about this. What have you tried? What didn't work? And what have you consumed that also contributed to this stance?
Yeah. So there are some really great educational products out there that are not created by me. And so I think when I think about the things that I've tried all kinds of things. I've done cohorts. I have done one-off webinars and classes. I have done, you know, like a timed month where you move through, and have built all of that, you know, over the years, I think. And I've also built classes for other people. I think when you need to get like a top line understanding of education, these courses can work. So as an example, I have up on my site right now a 50-minute webinar about how publishing works. That can be a really important thing for someone who
charge $50 for it.
Yeah. Yep. Mm-hmm. And it honestly, most people come to that when they've heard me somewhere, they've heard me talk about it. I can't take every call in the world. So I send that link to a lot of people when I can't take the call. And because so much of it is just the same thing around understanding publishing and how you get a book. And so I think in that top line education, it works. And I think it also works when the person is a online learner, where as we become, you know, like more dialed expertise, there's very specific questions and challenges that are needed. And so I think that like that personal experience. So I've tried it all. When I say the educational piece is bullshit, what I think that I mean in that is this off the cuff comment of just create a course and you'll make $1 million is bullshit. So many people say that, and it is such an art. I know a number of people who have made incredible money creating educational experiences, and it's a real workflow, knowing that specific audience, having something that can help them. But typically I find the people I know that are doing it really well are helping other people make money. And so it's like a business to business type of course. I say all of this to say, I'm also someone who has, I forget with all the translations, I have three courses on LinkedIn. So I have 150,000 learners that have gone through my LinkedIn courses. How to find meaning.
What are these courses? Purpose. Oh, sorry, you're about to say them.
Yeah. How to find meaning and purpose, how to support colleagues from marginalized communities, and then how to find your spark at work over the years with LinkedIn. Those are the three that I've done. I have made from those courses close to $85,000 because it was advances first that were between 5 and 10K per course. And then another $68,000 over the years of just like monthly recurring revenue of once I, sorry for me, it's profit, money in my mailbox money, where, you know, these courses have done really well on LinkedIn. And sometimes they promote them, sometimes I promote them because the advance has been earned. They do really well. And they're kind of this like evergreen content. So that is doing well because the person, the learner coming to it, likes online courses. They get certifications, right? So it's built into like a broader ecosystem. But that has been one of the big surprises for me was how well those LinkedIn courses have done. They were major, like production values very high. The diligence in there's quizzes to test learning and understanding. There's Q&As with me. Like a lot is built in that actually delivers. Like when we come back to what we were talking about with speech writing, what's in it for them? It comes all the way back, right? It's designed into how can not I make money as a course creator? But LinkedIn is really diligent about like, if we're going to make a course together, it has to deliver on a transformation for that learner.
If you're building your whole video business on platforms like YouTube, here's the uncomfortable truth. They own the audience relationship, not you. That's where Open Video comes in. It lets you host your videos on your own domain under your own brand so you control the channel, the data, and the direct connection to your viewers. And now with the new Open Video MCP server, you could do even more without taking your focus off of your content. With their MCP server, an AI agent can upload, tag, organize, and even analyze your entire video library from a single prompt. Your video stays yours, the busy work gets automated, and you can focus on creating. Check out Open Video for all the details. That's open.video.
Well, say more about like how your brand, how you're using your platforms to show up over the next few years. I know that on LinkedIn, you've started posting the past 2 weeks. You've got like 6 posts. Engagement is not yet great, which, you know, you're sort of warming it up again. You hadn't posted it for six months before.
Algorithm. Thank you, Francis.
And on Instagram, you do well, though. I think you've got about around 23,000 followers there, and your posts are fairly well engaged. Twitter, you abandoned in 2022, I believe. Facebook, similar. So Instagram's sort of your main platform. But are you – and, of course, there's the newsletter at the center of it all, which we talked about earlier. How over the next couple of years are you thinking about this and reactivating this and bringing yourself out there?
Yeah. I'd be curious if anyone else has experienced this cycle of having been very online and then kind of retreating, which is something that I did. And I had what I would consider a pretty crappy attitude about it. Like I was annoyed that in order to grow, I had to give so much of my time, energy, and attention for free to platforms that were making a ton of money off me. That was my mindset then. And I was just kind of like, as the time went on, I just kind of got more and more jaded about it, which is funny because I was fine with it from 2012 to 2021.
Well, and the engagement was probably flowing easier.
Good point. Like my resilience may not have been there because it might have been flowing easier. And it not might have, it was. And then things changed. And also, I was having a hard time figuring out the model. You might remember this. The people that were kind of experts in a field, they were growing and getting somewhere. Like I remember the Rachel Hollis, Girl Wash Your Face. Like You're Not Lost was like in that ecosystem. And she was like many books in. I do not know her. So this is, I was just kind of watching what she did. And it went from very specific content to then like a media company about sharing every moment of a life. Right. And you saw that model a lot. It wasn't like we can just talk about. Yeah. And like, we can't just talk about the work. We also have to create a podcast with our husband and what it's like to raise kids. And it just became about like, how we're redesigning the house. But like, everybody came to you for this like original career content. I was feeling that pressure and didn't want to do it. And so in not wanting to do it, I retreated. I retreated at a time that then other things were going on and kind of made sense. And I was in Savannah, I was in this like little creative cocoon. I've since gone back to San Francisco, right? So this has layers, like the coming back out has layers. But what I realized, and you hit on it on Instagram. So about 6 months ago, and I did this with the writing coach, right? I was like, I'm not getting out of my own way. So I need to make some kind of financial investment or accountability that gets me out of my own way. So I hired a social media agency where I'm writing the content, I'm filming the content, I'm writing the captions, I'm setting up the many chat, like all of that. But they're editing and putting it across platform. And so the acknowledgement that I came to around that time, the reason for that became, you can write really good books, but if nobody knows about them, nobody knows about them.
Agreed.
And so, yeah. And so I was like, I got to get out of my own way with this. Like my friend, Jackie Johnson, the founder of Create and Cultivate, has talked about this recently, and it's really spot on. You know, she talks that it's not, it's about being best known. Like many of us thought like, oh, I had the best product. I had the best book. I, you know, whatever, I have the best service, but it really becomes about the best known of those things. And I'm, you know, really fortunate that since 2018, I've been helping other people become best known behind the scenes. And now, you know, like, what does it look like to pull a lot of that skill set around both for myself and for other people, and then just committing to it. And so, you know, when I look at Instagram engagement as an example, I have posted every day on Instagram since beginning of mid-October. And if you were to look at the numbers, like, sure, have there been a couple that have popped off? Great. But there's no major change. There's not like some insane amount of followers. What there is, though, is a lot of people sliding into DMs, a lot of people calling me. I had said, you know, if I book one speaking engagement from this investment in 6 months, then it'll have been the right thing. I booked two. And did it happen because they saw an Instagram post and then called me? No, it was, they saw me very visible again. Mm-hmm. And then when they had an opportunity, I was top of mind.
This came to mind when you were talking about the other person who, you know, you're talking about multiple people and how it sounds like, oh, maybe they tried to scale their media business and bring it on in this way that didn't necessarily make sense. And then also, like, that's when I first saw this, but also in the context of you kind of coming out of the public image and then coming back in now, it made me think of one of my favorite songs, Atlantic City by Bruce Springsteen. But there's this lyric, everything dies. Maybe that's a fact, but maybe everything that dies someday comes back, which maybe is a bit corny to bring up here. But you know what I mean? That's kind of how it works. You have to know when it's appropriate.
You're saying
for a thing
I
to
died
end.
And came back, and the answer is she is.
Yeah, no, but with no. I firmly believe that in media, in creator media especially, where there are some ill-planned plays to like turn something that works in one way into something larger and scaled. It's like, no, sometimes it's okay for a thing to sunset and leave. And then like you, a few years later, maybe you come back with a new play, but the point is not to drag that thing on until it's bankrupt, right? You let it go at the right time, and then you build the new thing.
Yeah. And you build other skill sets. And I love that. I don't know if you were reading some of the recent coverage on like a lot of these longtime podcasts are sunsetting. Mm-hmm. I thought it was super interesting. And they're very, you know, many of them are very successful that they were reporting on. I also, when, as you shared that lyric, I think about one of the pieces, one of the profiles that impacted me the most in thinking about this kind of cyclical nature of where we go to do deep work and deep evolution. Like, I'm a different person than I was 6 months ago, or six months ago too. but you know, I think about that evolution, how that shows up in what we create and what is like finding life from us. I think about a profile written about Adele, because Adele is famous for doing these massive albums and then she retreats and she's not really everywhere to be found, at least in those first, you know, few albums. Right. And so what the quote that she gave has stuck with me forever and ever, because she said, "I cannot write an album about life if I haven't actually lived that life."
Mm-hmm. Certainly.
And we have to create from somewhere, right? And so for me, this won't be the last time probably that there is this nature of deeply learning a craft like fiction in a cocoon, or deeply understanding ghostwriting at another level before I come back and allow those things to come together. Because wow, has these skill sets really shown up in ways that play with one another, that support other parts of the work. You know, even in like us talking about Instagram and LinkedIn, and, you know, we now have tools of automation, AI, like having this like deep understanding of storytelling. I've always considered myself a storyteller, but now to actually know what that looks like and means is really good timing for it, because I don't know if I'd be able to grapple with these tools in the same way. So yeah, like I think it's a beautiful thing for us to think about, like what are the boundaries. And for me, I have my boundaries on what I share and don't share. Like, I'm not really down to share who I'm dating or what's going on in my family or like intimate moment. Like, I've got the boundaries around it. Now it seems like the platforms allow for that a little bit more than they did 6 years ago. But, you know, it's just we're all evolving with it.
Speaking of boundaries, I think we have reached the end of this episode of the Creator Spotlight Podcast.
We did it.
Lexi, thank you for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
And listener, we will see you next week.
Hi there, my name's Tom. I'm the producer of the Creator Spotlight Podcast. If you enjoyed that episode and are looking for another episode centered around ghostwriting, then I'd recommend the episode with Nicholas Cole. It's our most popular episode. He teaches thousands of people every year how to make money writing online, and there's tons of information in there. I'd recommend that one next.